This is session 221, Relief Society and the Invisible Hand of Patriarchy. And obviously following the unwritten order of things, they have a man to preside even at this session. So, just some reminders, if you have anything that beeps or makes noises, please turn that off. And then at the time, at the end, when there's questions and answers, if you'll come up to the microphone so we get everything on recorded. We have two presenters today. We have Tamara Taysom and Ellen DeCoe. Tamara holds a BA and in English and an MS in elementary education, both from Indiana University, and is currently working on an MA in colonial history at the University of Utah, where she is the president of the student chapter of Sunstone. She has interest in education, history, and feminism, and is currently working on various projects, including looking at racially segregated schools in the Midwest, female teachers in early Utah, women in education leadership in Chicago at the turn of the 20th century, and education of girls in the Third World. Ellen DeCoe is a native of Belgium. She lived in Antwerp for the first half of her life and Provo for the second half. She enjoys traveling, which is good because she has to do it often. She's currently completing a BA in sociology at Brigham Young and is considering her options for graduate school. So I believe Tamara is going to go first, and then Ellen, and then there should be some time for some question and answer after.
Before I start, I'd just like to say that I am the president of the Sunstone at the University of Utah, but I'm also the only member at the moment. So if you're interested, could you please contact me sometime during the conference, because if we don't get at least three members, we won't have a budget. So I would really appreciate that. When I first told a friend that Ellen and I were presenting at Sunstone on the subject of Relief Society and the Invisible Hand of Patriarchy, she said, "Oh, is it invisible? Seems pretty visible to me." So of course she is right. Patriarchy is very visible in Relief Society. Without using the term patriarchy, we talk about it all the time. Every time I turn around, it is time for another lesson in Relief Society on priesthood or patriarchy. But part of the strength of patriarchy in the church is its ability to hide its power and influence and to appear to be as natural and harmless as the trees and flowers. In a discussion with a man in the church a few years ago, I expressed my belief that men controlled Relief Society. He laughed and said, "I don't really get that. I could never be the Relief Society president," as if being Relief Society president was not a puppet government. This is the invisible hand I'm talking about. Relief Society is controlled subtly by men behind the scenes in such a way that their control in Relief Society is unseen and can be denied in the face of accusations that women are treated unfairly in the church. French scholar Michel Foucault is very clear that power is never a sure thing. It is an elusive, fluid thing. It is not stable or consistent. Its boundaries require constant surveillance if they are to remain in place, and challenges to power can crop up from everywhere. Sometimes power can be overthrown, but as historian James C. Scott explains, it rarely is. One of the main reasons for this is that power structures have methods in place which shore it up and guard it against attack. The church effectively and carefully guards the power of patriarchy through numerous tactics. In this presentation, I will focus on only a few. Number one, hegemony and the elasticity of patriarchy, and then the collusion of women in the perpetuation of patriarchy. But first, a few definitions. Patriarchy, wherever it is found, and it is found almost everywhere, is characterized by several traits which include the domination of men and control of social structures, laws, and resources by man. Patriarchy defines men, their bodies, and what they do as the norm. And lastly, patriarchy puts men at the center, making them very visible. They are seen, heard, and acknowledged far more than others. This is obvious in every gender conference. The story of an elementary school teacher illustrates how men are socialized at a very young age to expect to be the center of everything. The teacher feared that she was calling on boys far more than girls. I'm a teacher, and I know this happens. It's very difficult to avoid. Partly because boys are used to, they know how to get the attention of the teacher. And this is, it's really hard. Without discussing this tendency of the class, the teacher instituted a system to monitor herself and to call on girls just as much as boys. This evened out the opportunities for participation between the boys and the girls in the class, but after a few weeks, the boys complained that she was calling on the girls much more. The boys expected to be the center of the class and to enjoy more than their fair of attention in the class. If they did not get it, they believed that things were unequal. Literally, patriarchy means the rule of fathers. This is important because patriarchy is often used interchangeably with men, which suggests that all men are part of the patriarchy, or that all men are powerful within the patriarchy, which is certainly not the case. Patriarchy is the rule of men who occupy the place of fathers in families, wards, clubs, political groups, workplaces, cotton plantations, universities, etc. Men who are in charge, these are men who are in charge of everyone else. Men of color are traditionally left out of patriarchy. The Mormon patriarchy is just one example of that until 30 years or so ago. Men of color are still largely absent from the ranks of general authorities. Homosexual men are also left out of the patriarchy. I might even say almost ceremoniously kicked out of the Mormon patriarchy. Another group that is left out of patriarchy is very old men. When we Americans think of very tribal patriarchies, like in some primitive society, some generic primitive society, we often imagine that the oldest male member of the tribe enjoys the most respect or power. I have no idea if this is true or not, but it is not true in the West. Retirement is the kiss of death for many powerful men who have no one left to boss around but their wives. In the church, only 15 men, the members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, are guaranteed to remain in power within the patriarchy until their death. The rest of the men will at some point be dropped forever from any meaningful role in church patriarchy. A few years ago, I went to a wedding reception and one of my mission companions, and my mission president was there. And I, you know, asked him how are things going and everything. And he said, "Well, you know, I just teach high priest for him. You know, that's all I do. Nobody ever asked me to do anything." And I felt kind of sorry for him, but I also thought, you know, welcome to the pasture. You know, I never came in. You know, and you know, you never invited me in. I worked under you for a year and a half, and you know, I was never anybody. So, you know, now you know how it feels. It's sort of what I felt like. But in general, this is a problem in the church, that men do enjoy the thrill of patriarchal leadership, of priesthood leadership, and when they're released, many of them have terrible problems. And I think actually it's a problem in the church. German philosopher Robert Filmer explains that historically, patriarchy derives its power from the power of kings. And it is a form of government in which male heads of households rule over lesser males and all females. In fact, patriarchy is really a power structure of a few select men. In other words, all members of patriarchy are men, but not all men are members of patriarchy. In the church patriarchy, not all men are equal to all other men. If they were, it would not be a hierarchy, which it certainly is. Moreover, most men rotate in and out of higher positions in patriarchy. They are not always leadership positions in the church. Male primary teachers, for example, certainly are not. Nor are male ward organists or male members of activities committees. Nevertheless, because of the lay clergy structure of the church and the fact that all worthy male members of the church may hold priesthood, it is inevitable that priesthood, which constitutes the patriarchy of the church, will be associated with men and only with men. Moreover, when men serve in positions that are not in patriarchy per se, such as primary teachers, they do not stop holding the priesthood. In this sense, they are always part of the patriarchy, even if they are at the bottom of it. So, patriarchy is the structure of a few select men, or at least a few select men at any one time. But all men in the church have a shot at being in a powerful position in patriarchy. No women do, nor can they ever expect to in their lives. If she ever holds a position of patriarchy in the church, a woman will never hold it over men, except in the rare cases where she's allowed to be in charge of work that doesn't really matter, like childcare or music. On the other hand, once a boy reaches a certain age, he can expect that he will never again be under the jurisdiction of women in the church, except for a few temporary situations like those I mentioned above, where work doesn't really matter, like childcare or music. In these, the women, on the other hand, will be under men in the church from their birth until their death. All of this privileges all men over all women. Aaron Silva wrote in Dialogue that the ecclesiastical structure of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a patriarchal system whose imperative is male hierarchical hegemony. It is based on the rule of a few selected men through the principles of power and authority claimed from God. All of this privileges all men over all women. Adrian Rich defines it this way: patriarchy is a familiar social, ideological, political system in which men, by force, direct pressure, or through ritual tradition, law and language, customs, etiquette, education, and the division of labor, determine what part women shall play or not play, and in which the female is everywhere subsumed by the man. I was not particularly bothered by the patriarchy of the church until my relocation to Utah a few years ago. I was raised in the church, but outside of Utah, and spent almost my entire life away from Utah. I think the reason that I was not as frustrated by the patriarchal nature of the church until a few years ago was that I enjoyed a world outside of the church, Monday through Saturday, where women were gaining more and more credibility, respect, authority, and prestige. With my move to Utah, I exchanged my Hispanic Catholic female principal, this is in Houston, who believed, who never raised her voice to anyone and asked my opinion about almost everything, for a Mormon male principal who believed he was entitled to his position by his priesthood and would yell at me publicly if I disagreed with him, and who had to be supplied with piles of evidence before he would discipline little boys who call little girls sexist names on the playground. In fact, I had to live with male Mormon patriarchy all week long, and it made me more aware and more frustrated than I had ever been before. All of this brings us to an important word used in association with male, with priesthood. It is power. Patriarchy is about power. Priesthood is about power. But it is not about the power to move mountains, contrary to what it says in scriptures, or to change people's lives. It is about the power to control people's lives and to, quite frankly, be in their business. It is about the power of being in charge. It is about being the boss. It is about dominion. Even children and youth in the church understand this. A few years ago, when I was in Houston, I had a master's degree, I was a school teacher, and I was a single woman living in a family ward. And one day they announced that this kid in the ward was going to be ordained to be a deacon that week. And, you know, everybody just waved your hand and that was fine. And then for some reason I was hanging around after church and this kid was out there in the foyer. And I didn't even know this kid. And he said to me, "You know what?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Next week, I'll have more power than you." Well, I didn't know what to say, but I did include it in a talk a few weeks later and was asked to sit down. But anyway, never mind. I know they know where real power is, who has it and who does not, and they understand that in the church it depends on gender, not age, righteousness, lineage, or anything else. Now let me return to my list of methods that are used in the church to maintain the power of patriarchy and the closely associated privilege of men. Hegemony and elasticity. Feminist Kate Millett wrote, "Perhaps patriarchy's greatest psychological weapon is simply its universality and longevity." Another writer explained that male hegemony consists of a multiplicity of moments which have persuaded women to accept male-dominated culture and their subordination within it. Women are drawn into patriarchy because their conditioning is so complete. They have come to believe that they are second-class citizens and that that is the way it should be. Catholic feminist Frances O'Connor explains that much of the power of patriarchy in any religion lies in the fact that it exists everywhere, but is so common and quiet that it is rarely detected. She writes, "For women to exist in the suffocating atmosphere in the patriarchal church is analogous to struggling to survive in a house where carbon monoxide is spreading through every room. Patriarchy, like carbon monoxide, is insidious because it is colorless, odorless, and invisible. The human body does not detect the presence of carbon monoxide. It interprets the gas as oxygen. Likewise, women are not even aware that they are absorbing patriarchy into their systems. As with the air they breathe, they take the patriarchal system for granted, rarely think about it at all. Yet its effects are deadly." Historian Judith Bennett explains that patriarchy is everywhere, but it is not everywhere the same. It is flexible in the sense that it can vary in form and degree. Bennett again, "The concept of patriarchy might be singular, but its manifestations certainly are not. Examining the historical workings of patriarchy entails writing the many histories of many patriarchies and its many forms and the many systems through which it has thrived." Historian Judith Bennett explains that patriarchy's ability to morph into something slightly different is like the flu virus that morphs just enough to evade detection by the human immune system and thus survives to attack again another flu season. This ability to change form contributes to its elusive nature. In preparing this presentation, I read numerous articles and books just to get a handle on what we mean when we say patriarchy. Everyone knows what we mean, but no one knows what we mean. And herein lies its power. Bennett calls this the equilibrium of patriarchy. Despite the many changes of history and the progress of women's rights, patriarchy still exists and rules the lives of women the world over. In history, it is a broad, overarching constant. Bennett and feminist Juliet Mitchell agree that because patriarchy exists in so many forms that patriarchy exists in so many forms, and if women make gains against patriarchy in one sector of their lives, that gain will almost certainly be countered with a loss in another sector of their lives. And she gives two examples of this. One is, we don't have laws that say women have to be in by a certain time at night. But we do, but if a woman is out at night and is raped, well, she shouldn't have been out. So, you know, we had a legal system that kept women in at night, and that was lifted. But then another area, another kind of patriarchy rose up and said, but if you're out and you're raped, oh well, you know, you should have known. Instead of saying, that man shouldn't have raped that woman. So that's one example. And then another example she gave is her research is in Middle Ages in England, and she studied women who sold beer and ale in 1300 in England. And apparently, I'm a woman, I don't understand these things, but at this period, there was a change in the way that beer and ale was manufactured, and it made selling it much more profitable. And at that time, the only people that sold beer and ale were women. As soon as it became a profitable enterprise, there it starts to appear in culture things that, like brewsters, women who sold beer and ale, were untrustworthy. They were, sluts. They were whores. They were this and that. And within a few hundred years, men had taken over the industry. So, you know, as soon as they began to make it profitable, something else stepped in and took it away from them. So you have these different sectors of patriarchy filling in for each other. So one gain equals a gain for feminism or women's rights is countered by a loss of women's rights. Okay. As soon as women became economically successful, that success was countered effectively by responses rooted in ideology, law, politics, culture, and/or the family. In the end, patriarchy had changed form, but it still reigned supreme. The elasticity of patriarchy in the Mormon Church has not had a lot of give or wiggle room in the last 40 to 50 years, but it does exist. One of the best examples of this, I think, is the one or two women who speak in General Conference every year. When Barbara Smith first spoke at General Conference, it was the first time members of the church had seen a woman speak at General Conference in their entire lives. Since then, women have spoken in every single General Conference. It is a very small concession. Out of the 45 or 50 talks given in a single General Conference, may one, maybe two women speak. Almost without exception, they speak on Saturday when fewer members of the church are in attendance. Their talks are short. Their message is typically pro-patriarchy. This change hardly amounts to a revolution. In fact, it is done to prevent a revolution. It is a move that buys the patriarchy of the church a long respite from complaints about equality of women in the church. And it confirms what feminist writer Alan Johnson says about patriarchy. It is easier to allow a few women to assimilate into the patriarchal structure than it is to question patriarchy itself. You can almost hear general authorities saying, "Let the woman say a few words. What's it gonna hurt? Throw them a bone, and then we can get back to the important stuff." As it turns out, this supposed gain for women turned into a gain for patriarchy because they were able to use the woman who did speak in General Conference to promote a pro-patriarchal message. And this leads me to my next point, the collusion of women in patriarchy. Bennett explains that women are not passive victims of the power of patriarchy. They have colluded in, undermined and survived patriarchy. The history of patriarchy is not, therefore, a history of only women, of only men. It is a history of women as survivors, resistors, and agents of patriarchy. It is a role that women have played as the agents of patriarchy that I want to focus on now. Millett explains that this is called interior colonialization. I'm interested in this because of my interest in colonial history. O'Connor describes women as people who stand with the tide of patriarchy. I like my mother's terminology the best. She calls them simply mistresses of patriarchy. Whatever words you use, this is a phenomenon in which members of an oppressed group buy into their own oppression and jump to defend it, especially when other members of the oppressed group pose a threat to the power of the oppressor. Similar phenomena exist in other oppressive systems, such as colonialism, hence the phrase, or slavery. In the case of patriarchy, mistresses of patriarchy defend the male privilege of patriarchy and priesthood to women who may be less convinced of it or who may be outright opposed to it. These defenses often occur in official settings, in the official settings of Relief Society. Okay, now, this happened a few years ago to my mom. My father's a patriarch in the church. He doesn't, he's not well enough to give blessings anymore, but at the time that this occurred, he was, and the lesson was on patriarchs. Not patriarch blessings, but patriarchs. And the teacher said to my mom, "Why don't we ask Martha what kind of men become patriarchs? What kind of men are patriarchs?" And my mom said, they are very, very ordinary people. And, I mean, she was his wife. She knew everything about him. She watched him get dressed in the morning. She just knew that he was an ordinary person. She loved him. She had married him. She's still married to him. They have a good marriage. But she wasn't bedazzled by him. And this led to some very scathing comments from other women in the Relief Society who said that, you know, I can't remember all of what happened, but it was something like, how dare she say that she, that he wasn't, like, incredibly powerful, that he wasn't incredibly wonderful, that he wasn't, you know, like, the best man in the stake, and all of this stuff. And, I mean, there were three or four women who jumped on her, and, by the way, these are women whose husbands were not nearly as high up in the patriarchy. And from what I could tell, living my whole life in the church, they would never be married to men who had any kind of authority in the patriarchy. And yet, they came to the defense of patriarchy against my mother, who they perceived as a dissenter against patriarchy. Now, this is, it's important to note that my mother did not say, well, the priesthood is not important. She did not say, well, he's a nice guy, but I would be a better patriarch than he would. She did not say, all men are jerks. She did not even say that one man was a jerk. All she said is, my husband is a very ordinary man. And for that, she incurred wrath from other women, and it was hot. I was there, I remember, it was, I mean, she was jumped on, and it's an experience that's burned into my memory. O'Connor explains that there is nothing new or powerful about the, nothing new about the powerful exploiting the differences between various subordinate groups. The history of capitalism is replete with such underhanded, sinister techniques, and it is no wonder that patriarchy and capitalism have made such comfortable bedfellows throughout history. Kate Millett is clear. One of the chief characteristics of patriarchy is the tendency to set one woman against another. In the past, this created a lively antagonism between whore and matron, and in the present, between career woman and housewife. One has security, prestige, and respectability. The other has adventure, experience, and her own money. Millett continues, the man participates in both the domestic and the public sphere and is empowered by his superior social and economic resources to play the estranged women against each other as rivals. So it is clear that there are advantages to patriarchy when women fight. But what advantage is there to women to fight against other women and to defend the oppressor? Why do some react almost violently when it is suggested that men or patriarchs are not as special as we had hoped? Why does patriarchy engender such loyalty? Feminist Gerda Lerner writes that this cooperation is secured by a variety of means: gender indoctrination, education deprivation, the denial to women of their knowledge of their own history, the dividing of women one from another by defining respectability and deviance according to women's sexual activities, by restraints and outright coercion, by discrimination in access to economic resources and political power, and, here's the main point, by awarding privileges to conforming women. Let's look at this last item for a moment. The privileges awarded to conforming women are tiny. They are only crumbs falling from the rich man's table. But many women would rather have crumbs than nothing. They are afraid if they push the envelope, they will end up with just that, nothing. O'Connor writes that in the end, mistresses of patriarchy cling so tenaciously to the patriarchy because the price of letting go is simply too high. It will cost them too much. Some of them have nothing in their entire lives to pay the price with. They have spent their lives becoming the women that patriarchy expected them to become. if their dissent causes patriarchy to withdraw their support now, they will be left with nothing, spiritually, emotionally, or financially. Another woman wrote, "To invite women into feminism is to invite them into a very painful place. They can't read the Bible the same way. They can't go to Mass." This is a Catholic feminist talking. "They can't go to Mass the same way. They can't read the New York Times the same way. Everything is different. Everything has changed once they have had that conversion, and it's painful and wonderful at the same time. Those who do not enter in are held back by a deep sense that they are going to lose more than they are going to gain. I know this is true of many Mormon women. They cleave to patriarchy because they are afraid they no longer have any other choice. Quite frankly, it is the reason that I often forego making dissenting comments in Relief Society. I worry about the feelings of women who depend on patriarchy. The thought that patriarchy is a bad thing, or anything less than we hoped it might be, is simply too awful for them to contemplate. I know that I will be all right. I will go home from Relief Society and I will go on with my life, but they may not. So I often remain silent." So what do we do? Ellen and I explored many solutions to the problem of patriarchy and Relief Society in the church. We made a rather long list, but we feared that none of them would ever realistically be considered, and I'm just going to reel off a few of them. Allowing Relief Society to have their own money. Look at the way I worded it. Allowing Relief Society. Not going to happen. Women, not men, should choose who will be the leaders in Relief Society. Not going to happen. Relief Society leaders should be in charge of women's repentance, not male leaders. I don't see it happening. All members must have their temple recommend signed by a member of their own gender and by one of their own sex and by one of the opposite sex. I don't see it happen. Relief Society manuals should be written by women and should only quote women. I don't see it. Men should be banned from coming into Relief Society at any time for any reason. The way that women, I mean, try a fun experiment sometime if you're a woman. Walk into priesthood and just see what happens. I was actually going to do it so I could tell you a story, but I don't have the courage, you know. All of these solutions are tempting, but they are almost laughable in that they will never even be considered. I have long hoped that Relief Society would be the answer to problems women face with patriarchy in the church, and I would be thrilled if someone would convince me again that it was true. I worry, however, that Relief Society has been so thoroughly commandeered by men that any solution now lies outside the confines of Relief Society. I do believe that the answer does lie in the hearts of women. My faith in women and their power is not shaken by the research I've encountered about patriarchy in preparing this presentation, but I am becoming convinced that Relief Society will never again be what it was before correlation. I will never be as powerful in the church as my grandmother was. Relief Society will never again have any real power, nor will it ever again empower women in the church. The privileges afforded to men by patriarchy and male-only priesthood are simply too tempting to men, and they will never give them up. I'm going to skip a little bit here. So what do you do? It occurs to me that strengthening and nurturing other women and reassuring them of their worth and power is worthwhile. If I could help other Mormon women build a healthy self-image and create for herself financial security, neither of which is dependent on men, they would be less likely to cling to patriarchy and to persecute other women in the name of patriarchy. I have known women who have done this. In a discussion some years ago in Relief Society, the teacher asked, "What could we do to support families?" The women responded that we could babysit for a tired mother or do our visiting teaching regularly. Then one woman, who was a successful lawyer, said, "I think if we really want to support families, we should pass laws that would more effectively track down deadbeat dads across state lines." That would be a blow to patriarchy. But do you see the difference between helping another woman and helping another woman become powerful? Another example, when my mother wanted to go back to school, she had five little kids at home, and finish her undergraduate degree, but was too afraid to apply, another woman in the ward went down to the campus, picked up the papers, and helped her fill them out. My mother now has a doctorate. This woman did not help my mother change a few diapers or get through a hard afternoon, though that is wonderful. But she changed the destiny of women down through the generations in a single family. I think we need to think more about this. If we are not used to thinking this way, we need to practice. Let's think big, not small. Simple acts such as these would help women restore their sense of self and their own power that have been destroyed by dependence on patriarchy. Ernest Bormann, a German writer, argued in 1975 that patriarchy destroys men as well as women. He wrote, "The tragedy of patriarchy is not only men's destruction of himself as a result of the attempt to make woman his slave, but the destruction of women's awareness of herself, the obliteration of all her recollections of her pre-patriarchal past. The blocking of the knowledge of who she once was, is today, and can be tomorrow. Mistresses of patriarchy have lost a true awareness of themselves. They see themselves only through the eyes of patriarchy. They can see little in themselves that men do not tell them to see. This blindness blocks their faith in who they once were and who they may become. They have forgotten that their souls are their own." Surely Mormon doctrine could do a little to help with this. We Mormons know better than anyone how we all, male and female, existed in a world before this one, a pre-patriarchal past, to use Bormann's words. We believe that we came into this world from that place, trailing clouds of glory. We declare to the world that our potential in the life to come is limitless. Godhood itself is within the realm of possibility. We are powerful. Men and women are both powerful because of our eternal destiny. Suppressing members of the opposite sex is not the essence of eternal power. Susan B. Anthony, whose faith in the end of patriarchy far surpasses my own, and who better than I knew what to do about it, is a feminist hero of mine. Her vision of the power of women over their own lives and souls is remarkable. I will end with her words. "The true woman will not be exploitive of another, nor allow another to be so of her. She will be her own individual self, stand or fall by her own individual wisdom and strength. She will proclaim the glad tidings of good news to all women, that women, equally with men, that woman equally with men was made for her own individual happiness, to develop every talent given to her by God in the great work of life." Thanks.
My student ward in Provo upholds a very special tradition. When the announcement is made, the Elders Quorum President and the Relief Society President walk into the Relief Society room with smiling faces and say, "It's time for our home and visiting teaching competition." The basic rule goes like this. Whichever organization has the highest percentage of home or visiting teaching at the end of the month gets treated to an evening with dinner and a show. And provided by the losing team, and what that entails, I will leave to your imagination. At heart of this competition is that home visiting teaching percentages have been dragging for too many months, and what better way to get the numbers up with a battle of the sexes? While I don't consider myself a joyless downer, a competition between Relief Society and priesthood, especially over home and visiting teaching, seems bizarre and out of place in a church setting. What would the early members of the Relief Society think of my ward, where competition, a stereotypical male attribute, is used to promote charity and unity? Perhaps this male, in a particular patriarchal influence, has always been part of relief society. In 1842, several Mormon women living in Nauvoo met together to draw up a constitution and bylaws to create a society of women called the Mormon Benevolent Society, but it would later be called the Nauvoo Relief Society and then the Relief Society. While Joseph Smith encouraged their efforts, he told them that he had something else in mind for their willingness in helping hands. He stated, "I have desires to organize the sisters in the order of the priesthood," and continued that the Society of Sisters might provoke the brethren to good works by correcting the morals and strengthening the virtues of the female community, and save the elders the trouble of rebuking, that they may give their time to other duties in their public teaching. Therefore, the creation of Relief Society organized the women, but also put them directly in function of the priesthood, and established their subordination in the new patriarchal religion. Even though the Relief Society was more independent before correlation, they were never entirely their own entity. To create a patriarchal structure with stratification based on gender, all that is needed is a perception that there is a difference in volition between women and men. Men, however, are not the problem. I come in peace. The problem lies in a system that is benevolent to men, which builds a hierarchical or layered structure and then institutionalizes it. Placing the work of the institutional church in the hands of priesthood leaders creates a demand that enhances the value of men. Women, of course, play a significant role in local congregations, but their work is in the nurturing aspects of Mormonism, nurturing the younger women, taking care of young children and families, and so on. Like the rest of the world at large, the question lies in whether these mothering and stereotypical female aspects are valued as much as institutional and administrative aspects are. It seems that women are bound by nature to take responsibility. If it seems that women are bound by nature to take responsibility for the poor and needy, and that men are not necessarily bound to do so, and are in a way excused from this task because of administrative tasks in the church, then it seems that men are the privileged group. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Sociologist Marie Cornwall states, "The tradition of women leading women became lost in the emphasis on priesthood line and priesthood authority. Functioning within the priesthood line of authority required ordination to a priesthood office as well as ordination from those with authority. Since women were not ordained, their only institutional role was to support the priesthood." Although the Relief Society Presidency is currently not allowed to act as spiritual mediators between women and God, the emphasis on priesthood authority should not limit Mormon women from creating a feminine sphere in Mormonism. Why shouldn't an all-female organization develop a certain kind of Mormon-based spirituality that works for them as women as a collective whole, but also on the level of complex individuals? Marilyn French, in her book Beyond Power, states the following in her concluding chapters. "Power has for too long gone unmodified, and in defiant disregard of basic human feelings and needs. Women are trained for private virtue, men for public power, and the severance between the sexes and the two realms is responsible for much of our irrational thinking and behavior. In each realm, one is requested to close the eyes to what the other is doing. To disconnect virtue from power is to ensure that virtue will be powerless and licenses power to be without virtue. I cannot say how or if this feminine sphere will be created. The idea that we can transform the world instantly, or that we will see a significant chance for the betterment of women in the church at the end of my lifetime, is utopian and idealistic. However, no movement has ever been more than an accumulation of small notions of people acting within their own spheres. Perhaps by steps made by motivated individuals, for example, by gaining an education and focusing on achieving greater equality in their own individual lives, we will be motivated by aspirations for progress and betterment, and perhaps this way this feminine sphere will blossom." And I'm going to kind of go sociological now, so sorry, this is what I do. As the church became more and more institutionalized, favorable to conservative politics and lifestyle, and a strong preference for women filling the roles of mothers and wives, so have many opportunities diminished for Mormon women within the church. Today, however, many young up-and-coming Mormon women, especially those of my age, are graduating from college and entering the workforce, not necessarily because of economic necessity, but because they want to, and many are delaying childbirth. Despite these women having to fight sexism every day in the workplace, they are able to have a voice, hold positions of power, and make decisions that have to be complied to. Additionally, many more households are headed by single mothers or married women to non-member husbands. There seems to be a widening gap between what the church teaches about women's roles and how these young women negotiate their positions in the world at large with their subordinate position in the church. As a result of a rapidly changing world, it seems that the patriarchal structure in the church seems to have entered a sort of identity crisis. No longer able to ignore, eliminate, or suppress the larger societal value of gender equality, the church is incorporating a form of ideological equality while preserving the structural inequality of its hierarchy and, some would argue, its gender relations. For example, the church has historically always encouraged the education of girls and women, but the pursuit of higher education has been understood as both supporting and subordinate to women's primary roles as mothers and wives, meaning that the educational outcomes for Mormon men and women are usually unequal. A sociological study conducted on Mormon women published in 2003 found, quote, that many Mormon women employ the discourse of equality and interpret the ideology of motherhood in ways that allow them to postpone marriage and childbearing and make it possible to pursue higher education. This interpretation legitimates their education while the behavior itself applies pressure on the church. The researchers argue that as women choose to delay the fulfillment of their primary roles, they apply pressure on the church from within. Thus, the pursuit constitutes resistance, but resistance conducted in a manner that simultaneously supports the hegemonic structure and exerts pressure on it to change and adapt. They call this embedded resistance, because the women are embedded in the system in every way, in their thoughts and in their practices. The researchers acknowledge that this is probably not the most effective means towards emancipation from inequalities, but it is a means by which they can expand their roles and achieve a greater level of independence and opportunity while retaining a nomos that provides them with identities and purpose. However, it is also not the most effective means towards preserving patriarchy for the power structure of the institution, but it is a necessary compromise, a negotiation, rendered by the church in effort to preserve its hegemony and membership in times of cultural change. While I cannot say that women obtaining a higher education is going to provide them with a much-needed voice in the church, I can only hope that it will encourage young women to think critically about equality. I know that my last 4 years obtaining a college education have been influential on my thinking and, more specifically, on my contributions to society at large. I do believe that much good can come from the Relief Society because of its already organized structure. During my years at BYU, I attended meetings of the organization called Students for International Development, where I helped in the community and raised awareness for the needs in developing countries. I participated in the feminist organization formerly called Voice, now Parity, and campaigned one spring morning on BYU campus to end violence against women, which involved marching through the Wilkinson Center with huge activist banners. Many of the sociology classes I've taken have taught me about inequality and poverty in my community and the world, and has taught me many valuable skills to reach out to people in the community and end poverty. Thus, even though the Relief Society may never gain the equal institutional status in the church, we should not write the organization off as stoic and unchangeable. However, we will see a generation, hopefully we will see a generation of women in the future who are able to combine their education and their membership of the Relief Society and make their mark on the good of society, and make their mark of good on their community and also the world at large, such as bettering the lives of women in developing countries. I already applaud the efforts of Relief Societies who meet in cultural halls to create humanitarian kits for people living in third world countries. More can be done. Because, after all, don't the general authorities tell us that the Relief Society is the largest women's organization in the world? I believe that with the right people and a little bit of boundary pushing here and there, The Relief Society can be a visible source for good of our in our communities and women around the world. Thank you.
It looks like we have about 10 minutes for questions, so if you want to just come up to the microphone to ask a question.
While sitting here, is this working?
Just close, really close.
While sitting here listening to the explanation of how women behave within the system and how we treat one another, it struck me that perhaps this is similar to the trauma response of abused children who defend and protect their abusers. And perhaps in insight into post-traumatic stress disorder or how victims behave may enlighten us and how we can empower women and heal women who are hurt by the patriarchy. Any thoughts on that? Or if I'm just way out in that field with these similarities?
No. It's on. I think you're right on. The only difference between what you're saying and what I'm arguing here is that one is on, you know, probably an individual basis with, you know, a counselor, and the other is a large group. But I think you're exactly right. The parallel is dead on. And there are other parallels. I was telling Ellen when we were preparing this that, I won't go into any specific examples, but examples of an oppressed group or individual colluding with the oppressor, it just goes on and on and on. History's full of it. But I do want to say, now that you've brought it up, that this was hard for me to put in the paper, because I do not want to blame women for the structure of patriarchy. I want to acknowledge that without their support, the structure falls. But I don't want to. It was tough to. I don't want to just be one more person who blames the woman who's, you know, who got raped because she was out at night. You know, I'm very uncomfortable with that. But there does seem to be something there, and I think you've hit on an area of research that would be very helpful and worthwhile in this regard. And maybe you can get that ready and present at Sunstone next year.
Thanks, that was awesome. Tamara, I really liked your presentation, but throughout it, I was really wondering about, you are an active member of the church?
Yes.
So I was really wondering about your...
Nobody has ever wondered about that before.
I'll ask again in 5 minutes. I was just wondering about your decision to posit the debate as being between they versus us. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not a member of the church, and I sometimes fall into the habit of saying we and us. But what am I talking about? I'm not going to get excommunicated.
I don't know.
Jump me in so they can jump me out. I thought that must have been a conscientious choice on your part in how you distinguish between saying, in talking specifically about women's collusion and patriarchy, you know, the pronoun was constantly they, but...
Are you talking about they as in they, the patriarchy, and then us as the feminists?
No.
Or the women?
Rather,
no, what?
They, women. Like, throughout your talk, when you said, the women who collude with the patriarchy, they do this, rather than
right. We
do this.
Oh, yeah.
That was why.
I guess I would like to think of myself as one who does not collude with patriarchy. I didn't work this into the paper, and I think I should have, the idea that agents of patriarchy or mistresses of patriarchy or women who collude with patriarchy, that that's a simplistic type of woman. It's a type of woman that may never really exist in real life. It's the sort of role that women move into and move out of depending on time and place, and from time to time perhaps we all fall into that role. I think I did it when I was on my mission, when I was talking to non-members who were wondering about male priesthood, and I didn't have any answers for them. And I think that I presented that for the sake of clarity in the paper as sort of a simplistic sort of woman that in reality may never exist. Does that answer your question?
I think as I was listening to your talk, I wasn't making that distinction at all. I guess it wasn't a distinction that I thought that you were making. Rather that, you know, if you were I think we all come up with patriarchy in different ways, whether we're inside the church or outside, but certainly if you are contributing your money, your time, your organization, your children.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
To that structure, then I guess I feel like a good place to begin is acknowledging that we are colluding with patriarchy, and there's no sort of us-them dichotomy, like they're doing it more because they're doing it with blinders on. Mm-hmm. We're all doing it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely completely agree with that, and Ellen and I talked about this at length, and she talked about it a little bit in her paper about the idea that women not only collude, but bargain. And yeah. When you bargain with patriarchy, that's a kind of collusion. And we talked about how it's done in, you know, how actually both of us have done it in temple recommended interviews and things like that. So it's and in that sense we stood in that role for that period. I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And as a side note, I did have an all girl punk band. I would like to name them Mistresses of Patriarchy.
Oh,
I'm giving
credit. I think you can do what you want. Power in a woman, right?
Just one thing that I skipped in my paper was that in terms of bargaining patriarchy, in a way like women, they're protected. Like, patriarchy protects women, and in the church's, you know, position, it's mostly from making choices, and also, like, you know, administrative choices, but also, you know, spiritual choices, like women not being able to be spiritual leaders for women. You know, all those choices with all those consequences rest on the shoulders of men, whether that's good or bad. So that was one of the things that I wanted to... Sorry.
Thank you. I have a question, I guess, or a need for clarification, or maybe both. Tamara, when you spoke, it seemed like it was about patriarchy being inherently evil and noxious, like carbon monoxide, and it's about dominion and control. Ellen seemed to allow maybe the power, if it was linked with virtue, there was some hope. And I guess I have to wonder, with the relief society becoming matriarchal, which you may not be able to imagine, but let's try to, if there wouldn't be downsides there that come with power and control.
Yeah, I just, power is, it's always, there always will be coercion and control. But what I find troubling with the Relief Society is that it's men controlling this all women's organization. And so, I mean, yeah, I really don't know how to answer your question. I think it'd be it's very utopian to hope for this perfect society. And also perhaps, because I talk about these, you know, different realms and how, like, one, like, if these different groups close their eyes to each other, like, coercion and manipulation will occur. So I think maybe instead of like all the women being separate and all the men always being separate and doing their own thing, there should be some form of, you know, collaboration and how that will happen, I don't know. I hope one day, you know, women and men in the church can work side by side and priests of power won't interfere and priestess power or whatever will have in the future. I hope that coercion will never occur.
I think the Doctrine and Covenants is clear that there is such a thing as or I just, I mean, I'm not sure whether I believe it, but I know there are a lot of people who do, and it's, I guess I would like to believe that as a teacher in my own classroom, I have dominion, and I use it righteously and fairly. I don't know whether it's true, and my students may not agree, but I, so that's a question, but I do think that... One of the problems with some of the things that Ellen and I came up with about, like, say, women being in charge of women's repentance, that's a very nice law on paper, but in reality, I think about, I'm a little worried that if some of the women in my ward were in charge of my repentance, I'd never get into the temple again, ever. Partly because I can't snow her the way I can snow the bishop, you know? And that's, you know, so I think in some ways women are often harder on women than men are. And in that sense, women have an advantage living under patriarchy. So, you know, I think you could argue it either way, and matriarchy is still a structure power.
All right, last question then.
Ellen, if there was no chance the university was listening right now, what would you say? What would you have written into your paper?
I would say... I think women should be ordained to the priesthood in order to have that voice. But then my fear is that they will still be incorporated back into that patriarchal structure. So... In a way, I really call for a complete overhaul of the system, but yeah.
All right. Well, thank you both, Tamara and Ellen, for a great session.
Thank you.